On the Empire Podcast this week, we follow the star of It Follows, Micah Monro, into our pod booth and then interview her. Plus, we take Pete's car, we drive over to Mum's, we go in, take care of Bill Nighy, then we grab Mum, we go over to Liz's place, hold up, have a cup of tea and wait for this whole thing to blow over. How's that for a slice of fried pod? Hello pod, I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast, the only movie podcast that will meet your needs in every department and which won't ask you to sign a contract beforehand. This week's safe word, just in case things get a little bit too hairy, Event Horizon. This week's safe word again, Event Horizon. Anyway, this week I'm joined by two of our most heroic and noble colleagues who have been inspired by this week's story that Neil Blomkamp is going to direct a new Alien movie, which was given a green light after he released concept art onto Instagram about a month and a half ago, and then this got given the green light last night. So they've been doing the same. First up is our art house guru, Phil Desemlian, who's currently beavering away on storyboards for Fitzcarraldo 2, We're Gonna Need a Bigger Boat, in which Nastassja Kinski drags a yacht over a bumpy hill. Phil, I'm excited about this. Are you excited about this?
Going well, Chris, so far.
Yeah.
Well, I'm hearing we don't have the budget for a hill. So it's more of a slight slope. When I say boat, it's more of a dinghy. But otherwise, it's going well.
Dragging a dinghy over a slight slope.
Yes.
I'd love to see that film. Next up is our geek queen, who's working hard on concept art for Supernatural the movie. Helen O'Hara, all you seem to have done so far is draw Jensen Ackles with his top off. And what's he doing to Jared? I'm just going to Google this. Jared Padalecki. What's he doing? What are they doing?
These people, they don't sound like people. They sound like...
No, they're
exotic
not people.
Skin
I actually don't believe in either of those people, Chris, as we've established before. But they do bear an uncanny resemblance, I will say, to Dean and Sam Winchester.
Oh, yes.
Whom I do believe.
And which one's got his top off in your concept art? Why's he got his top off? What's happening? He's rescuing...
He's just really warm, you know, and it got a stain on it. I don't know. It was horrible.
What sort of stain? Event Horizon. Right, let's have some questions now. You guys have been sending them in via Twitter all week. We're on a bit of an Oscar tip this week because if you're listening to us on Friday, then the Oscars take place on Sunday. If you're listening to us on Monday, then commiserations to everyone who wasn't Julianne Moore. Let's have some questions. From the first one, at WTB Alex, this sounds like a first-time questioner to me. If you want an Oscar statuette... if you want an Oscar statuette, where would you keep it? Brackets, I would fix it to my car bonnet as a hood ornament if I had a car. Oh, that's so sad.
That's a pretty awesome idea, actually. I mean, let everybody know you're coming, you know, with your Oscar. In a similar, actually, vein, I'd be tempted to do a sort of 1980s Beastie Boys. You remember they used to take car hood ornaments and wear them
just
around your neck?
Just wear it as like, yeah.
Yeah, wear it around your neck. I mean... Be upfront about it. I won an Oscar. There's no false modesty here. There's no modesty at all.
You would
I won
win
an Oscar.
Every single argument. I always imagine anyone who wins an Oscar goes into whatever meetings to do for the next 2 weeks, and if anyone, you know, complains or disagrees,
yes.
Bam, the Oscar goes to the table.
I'd like
going,
to see you.
Like Steven Spielberg in Austin Powers 3.
Precisely.
Exactly.
I would like to see you at a party with Flavor Flav, where he's got his clock, you've got your Oscar.
Yeah. There'd be clanking.
He can tell the time. You can just...
win things, be great, you know, stuff.
Be humble bragging 24/7.
They're no humble.
I'm wearing my... What are you wearing? I'm wearing an Oscar. I don't really have an answer to this one. But I did find something interesting about the Oscar, which is that, you know, it stands on the cine reel.
Yep.
With five spokes.
Okay.
One of those old-fashioned celluloid reels. And the five spokes represent the five arms of the filmmaking process.
No way.
Yeah.
Dude.
What are
yeah,
those?
I can't remember. No, they're actors, producers, directors,
wizards,
fluffers. No,
fluffers.
Sorry, that's a different
Event
sentence.
Horizon.
Event Horizon.
Technicians, dealers. No, writers.
Writers. Okay.
Writers.
Seems
they're
little...
like dealers.
Yeah.
The word dealers.
They deal thoughts and ideas.
I've got some words. Do you want 6 grams of words? I've got an 8-ball of grammar.
We don't know what any of that stuff means.
No. Again, I researched all
that. I cannot condone any of Phil's references at this moment in time. I know what I would do with mine.
What's that?
Which I would obviously win for something awesome. I would go around Kevin O'Connell's house.
Oh.
Kevin O'Connell, if you listened to the podcast a few weeks ago, is the man who currently holds the record for most number of Oscar nominations without a win. Is it 20?
18, I
18?
Think.
Hasn't been nominated since 2007. I would go around his house and I would taunt him mercilessly with it.
I thought you were going to hand it over like a mensch, but no.
No. I would let him get ever so close to touching it, and then I would just pull it away at the last minute. And the Oscar as well.
If you ever came close to winning an Oscar, I would Kanye the shit out of it. I would come up on stage and I would say, Chris does not deserve this. I would give it to anyone else.
I'm going to let you finish, but...
I wouldn't let him finish. I wouldn't let him start.
I'm going to let you finish. But David Spade is the greatest comedy actor of all time, and he deserves this. Is that what you would say?
I would just probably hit you.
Thanks, Phil.
No, Chris, I'd be delighted, but I don't think you should taunt this man. I feel he must feel a bit like...
Of course I wouldn't
taunt him. That's a relentless number of times he's got his hopes up and then had them dashed.
Maybe by the last time he just wasn't getting his hopes up at all. You know, maybe he was just going along, having a nice party. And
can you imagine if he went, he actually did win the next time he gets nominated? If he just gets blazingly drunk now because he thinks, I'm not going to win. And he just takes to this podium, hey! And just embarks upon a diatribe against all people.
This is how terrible speeches happen.
That would be an amazing idea.
That would be fantastic. Yeah. I don't have a mantle. Right. I would keep it next to the only other award I've ever won. I won something a few years ago. And it's on my DVD shelf in my house. And I would keep it next to that. And it would make the other thing look like shit.
It really would.
It
yeah.
would.
Yeah.
But let's be honest, none of us. You might, Helen.
Aw.
Honestly, you might win an Oscar.
What do you think I'd win it for?
Costume design.
Well, that's true. I am famously stylish.
That is a pretty damn good costume you've drawn there on... It's a Sam or Dean Winchester. It just seems to be a thong, but it's a pretty good one.
It's a well-designed one, right? It's keeping everything where it needs to be.
What would you like to win an Oscar for? Best animated short.
Best animated... That would be good, actually. Best animated short, yeah.
All right, okay. It's settled. Next year, then. This is a question. We kind of did this one last year, but I just want to throw it out, you guys, and see if you have anything new. It's from @Revolutionary, who asks, what new category would you most like to see added? Egg. Stunts, mocap, performance.
Best podcast, because then we'd have a chance. Not much of a chance.
Yeah, you say that.
Or any chance,
you
really.
Say that.
Okay, fine.
How big would the category need to be?
It would be a strange choice.
Best film podcast made by Empire.
I'm not even sure we'd be in with a shout then, to be honest. That would be a weird one. And now, please welcome, you've had Best Actor, Best Movie Podcast. It would seem a bit out of place with the rest of the night.
Nope, I completely think that's a seriously good idea.
We'd be in that montage of all the techie ones that are usually hosted by Jessica Alba, or Ter Leone, someone like that.
Oh, like you wouldn't like to go to the Oscars hosted by Jessica Alba. Come on, Chris.
Have you incepted me?
I asked Bruce Robinson about his experience with, which film would it have been he was Oscar nominated for? Was it The Killing Fields?
Yes.
It probably wasn't with Nolan, was it? Killing Fields. And he said they put you at the end of the row if you're going to win, in the middle if you've got no chance. And I was like, where did you sit? And he said, right in the middle. We would be in the broom cupboard downstairs with a double best robot.
Best robot. Well, this has gone as well as I expected.
Best craft. We were talking about this quite recently in the office, weren't we? Maybe best craft services. Because I'm really intrigued by food and food on set. Food. And it's good, often very good.
It is often very good. It's often also... absolute swill, but army marches in the stomach and all that. Last question is from @Rohan_go-to-bed, Event Horizon, who says, who is your favourite Oscar, actor, director, or any characters with that name, not picky?
It's Oscar Isaac for me. I'm sorry to be boring and obvious, but it really is. I did that video interview with him for Inside Llewyn Davis, and if you actually look at that video, you can actually see my eyes turn into little heart shapes like in a cartoon halfway through. It's quite embarrassing.
Woo!
Yes, but luckily they cut that bit out, thankfully. So yes, he's a great Oscar. Who doesn't love him?
He's a great Oscar. Where would you put him? That's probably a leading question.
Event Horizon, jeez, what?
Would you put him on your mantelpiece? Where would you put him on display in your house?
I see. Well, to be honest, if I had Oscar Isaac in my house, again, I'd want everyone to know about it. So he'd be in the living room, probably.
Strapped to the front wall, presumably. If you want everyone to see him, because otherwise you have to invite them all into the house.
I'd have to invite them all in, wouldn't I? Well, he could enter the door like a butler.
Dressed in just a bow tie.
So, what is it with you and the male nudity today, Chris? Jeez.
I'll put my jumper on, all right, for God's sake. If I had Oscar Isaac, I would do what WTB Alex does and just strap him to the front of my car and just drive around. why people will say to me, why do you have a terrified Oscar Isaac on the front of your car? I go, there you go. Just happened.
It's an apocalypse.
Phil, who's your favourite Oscar?
It's not really a film thing, but I guess Oscar the Grouch.
Good call.
Because finally parents that aren't afraid to give their child the middle name The.
Oh, I don't know. Drax's parents, Ronan's parents.
Okay, mm-hmm. But Oscar the Grouch was first.
Yeah, true.
Yeah, Oscar the Grouch. Also, I guess Fruitvale Station was quite good. And he's a real-life character, Oscar Grant.
Okay. Oscar for me, thing. Odd Couple for me. If you want to have your question read out on the Empire Podcast, and after that nonsense, why wouldn't you? You can send in your questions via Twitter. We're at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. You can Facebook us, Empire Magazine, is where we are on Facebook. And you can email us, podcast@empireonline.com. Okay, time now for our first interview. Micah Munro clearly has a thing for being chased by unstoppable killing machines, so she's come to the right place. She made an impact doing that very thing with Empire's spirit animal Dan Stevens in last year's The Guest. And she's at it again in next week's excellent It Follows, a horror film in which she's chased by a murderous spirit that's passed on to her, or infected, if you will, after she has sex. The strumpet. Rubber up, kids. Not for this interview, but just in general, be safe. Munro popped into the pod booth this week to talk to Phil and myself.
That was the most partridge thing ever. This is so earnest.
Sorry, Ali.
Sorry, Ali.
I just lost it because Phil, I can see Phil losing it. We're delighted to be joined on the Empire Podcast by the star of It Follows, Micah Munro. Hello, how are you?
I'm good, how are you?
I am very, very good, thank you very much. Thanks for coming in. On a long press tour for this film, we were just talking about it. You started last year.
Yeah, last year May okay. in Cannes, yeah. So it feels like it's been a very long time.
It must feel, in a way, like you're almost in the movie, but instead of being chased by some sort of sex creature, you're being chased by... the same question over and over again.
Yes, that's correct.
And it's just always there.
Yeah, always
what
there, waiting.
You to the film.
Yes, so yes.
just like yep. out of grasp.
Uh-huh.
What question have you been asked most?
Oh, gosh. Probably what attracted me to the film. What I first thought when I read the script.
Uh-huh.
That's kind of the most common one, and usually the interview starts with that question.
Okay. Well,
which makes sense.
We'll try and make it the fourth or fifth question.
Yeah, just throw that one down a few. That'd be great.
Have your answers changed over the years.
It's been years.
We started
feels
promoting
like
this film in 2012.
Yeah, exactly.
2 years before we started making it.
Yeah.
Has it changed, or do you, you know, is it difficult not to just give the same answer all the time, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, I try and, you know, vary it up a little bit and this and that, but overall, usually I have somewhat of the same response because it's, you know, my aunt's answer.
It's the truth.
It's the truth. Yeah. And it's, yeah.
Okay.
Do you, as you, you know, your career develops and you've done more and more films, does the way you read a script change slightly? Do you sort of... I'm just thinking there are scenes in this film, like there were in The Guest, mm-hmm. that look really grueling and arduous. I mean, being chained to things you know, night shoots. And as you get more experience, do you read the script and think, oh, okay.
So spot on. Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because reading It Follows, I'm like, oh, this is awesome. This is going to be great. And then I get there and I realize, like, holy shit, like, I actually have to physically and mentally go through this. And you're not really thinking when you read that. So now, I'm reading it like, oh. Don't want to do that. I've got to be, you know, in a pool for, you know, a massive scene. No, I don't want to do that because I know what that's like. Yeah. So definitely. Oh, yeah. I'm paying attention to that now, for sure.
Ignorance, I guess, is bliss, isn't it?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah.
I mean, we don't want to give very much away. We love this movie.
Yeah.
It's really, really fantastic. We don't want to give too much away to ruin it for people. But let's just say that there are... only presumably about 3 or 4 pages of script where you're not at a peak of sheer psychological exhaustion.
Yeah.
Those must have been the fun days on set, though.
Yeah, very few pages that were not, like, super incredibly intense, you know, screaming and running and stuff like that. It was quite nice, yeah. I don't really even remember those, though, with everything else.
The happy times.
Yeah,
before the dark times. So, what attracted you to the project?
Good one. Well, I read the script and thought it was incredibly odd. I saw Myth of American Sleep over the director's first film, and mm-hmm. it's so, you know, weirdly brilliant and amazing and so, so different. And I just thought, you know, you have that kind of dreamlike, hazy feel and you throw a horror movie into that. I thought it would be really interesting. And I think the director is incredibly talented and I really wanted to work with him.
We should put just a tiny bit of plot context.
Context?
I
can give a little something.
Oh, if you could. Oh, yeah.
Oh, you no, give it. You give
leave
it.
This to me.
Yeah. I'll leave that. Please, I want to hear. You go ahead.
So there's some people and they live in it's in America, right?
It's in America.
Okay.
Yeah.
And good, then good. Some things and then the demons.
Yeah, the demons.
A demon.
It's a sort of a demon. A goblin.
Okay.
Some form of sex goblin. Okay. I was hiding for quite a lot of it, I'll be honest. I'm hazy. Maybe you should take the reins on this one.
All right, okay. I'll give
not
it a crack.
Not you.
Then, no, I'll give it a crack.
Yeah, let's hear it. And then I'll come in. Correct.
So there's, you play a lady.
Oh, I do.
And you do the naughty thing with a man.
Yes.
Okay. Correct. We're British, so we have to be very British about that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And then as happens, as should happen to everyone who does the naughty thing, you are pursued by a sex creature. that's basically my take on it. Wants to punish you by killing you.
By killing you.
And then you're chased by a succession of, it takes different forms.
Forms, yeah.
And so there's a tall sex creature and then there's
giant,
there's an old lady and stuff.
Yeah.
But you probably can sell it. But
no, I think that's kind of, yeah. I mean,
there's a poster quote there.
Yeah, I would, God, that's great. We should tell David. Get that there. That's pretty
much spot on, I would say.
Pretty good.
Pretty spot on.
But
what the film does, I think Phil and I both loved, is it has this just feeling right from the off. In the sort of the jaws opening, if you will, with the character who's not you. There's this feeling of just inescapable dread that something is going to get you. And that's obviously the situation your character is in, where she's aware that this thing is coming after her and it will never stop and it can't be stopped.
Yeah.
It's such a tricky headspace to put yourself in. It's not something you can really go method on.
No, you can't.
So how did you go
really about
doing that?
It's difficult because I've never really experienced those things. That's me knocking on wood.
That's not wood.
Yeah. Not even sure this wood.
Well,
obviously.
I'm just pretending that it is. Yes, definitely. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, looks like it. Plastic version. But at least for me, because I want to make it as real as possible. I think for horror movies, you have to make it at all believable. Yeah, you have to have the performance, hopefully somewhat grounded. So for me, I'm using, you know, my own personal kind of darker spaces, things that can bring me to those places quite easy. And then of course, you know, half of it is the imagination and kind of living in that, which is not enjoyable to live in that at all. So
before these things start to unfold, before she does the naughty thing, why am I saying that? Before she has sex with this guy, they go on a date and they're queuing to see a film.
Yeah.
I think they're seeing Charade.
Yeah, something like that.
I thought it was really interesting that they're going to see, you know, which one? Okay, maybe that's a character detail too far.
Yeah, that's a question for David because he has so many odd little things, the little details that people start noticing throughout the film that are just so odd.
Yeah.
But kind of amazing.
It's nice. It must be nice though for your character because she has this game that she plays with her date, who turns out to be a lot more than she bargained for, obviously. Where it's like you have to guess who the other person would be if they weren't themselves in eye shot.
Yeah,
and then why?
I think it's a great game.
Have you ever played it?
It'd be so much fun. I haven't.
You should. Okay.
But I would like to. Yeah, I've actually forgotten about it until you reminded me now. Yeah, it's
give
a good
it a
game.
Go. Yeah, it's a really clever. I thought that that's really interesting because it tells a lot about
someone.
And then he goes, "I'd like to be that child," and then you work out why he says that quite quickly.
Yeah, quite quickly, why he wants to be a kid again.
Yeah,
to reverse time. Yeah,
absolutely. Mm-hmm. The last time we saw you was in The Guest.
Yes,
a film we absolutely adore as well. What is it about you and being chased by unstoppable killing machines? Is this just coincidence or is this something you said your agent? Right, I want to be chased.
I want to be chased by, yes. No, mm-mm. It was just, by total chance. I read The Guest and saw Adam's work, and I was like, I need to do this, and I fought for that role, and I wanted it so badly. And then it was kind of the same with It Follows. I just thought the character was so interesting and challenging, and just such a cool director, and kind of something, you know, super unique that people haven't really seen in a horror movie. I'm not going to be like, oh, I don't want to do any more horror. I mean, who knows what happens for me? I if I'm getting good scripts and characters, then I want to do it, and I'll fight for those roles. So, yeah, but it was just by chance that these came back to back.
And you read this one while you were doing the
Guest. Yeah, well, I sent my audition tape while I was on the set of the guest. Pretty sure, like, in my trailer, we just filmed the couple of scenes for the audition for It Follows. Yeah,
it's amazing though, because we absolutely love both these films, as I said. And Dan Stevens is someone who we adopted as a kind of spirit animal.
I think that's
in a way
fucking great.
After
that's
after
great.
The Guest,
yes,
he seems to be he's national treasure for us.
Good God,
at least.
That's amazing.
He hasn't signed the paperwork. it's a matter of time. His lawyers assure
us. It will happen. It will. I believe that. Yeah,
he knows this as well.
Yeah, he does. Good.
He's not been back since, as we said. But we're hoping. Yeah.
We were a bit creepy and weird with him. But that's fine.
Yeah.
It's okay. You okay there? You got
it. Yeah.
We have cheap microphones. Yeah. What can I say? But that film must have been an absolute blast to make.
The Guest?
Yeah,
oh, it was
Guest.
Great. I mean, I don't know. Have you guys met the director, Adam, yet?
I've only spoken to him on the phone.
Yeah, spoke to him. Okay. He's nuts. He's crazy. Amazingly crazy. And the writer, Simon, is probably one of the funniest people I've ever met. Just his super dry sense of humor. And even the producers, the two producers are just amazing. It's just an amazing group, and they always work together on their films, so everyone's super close. And obviously Dan's amazing. You guys know Dan. And so we're filming in the middle of nowhere, New Mexico. So there was literally a Taco Bell and maybe a, like, Carl's Jr.
Maybe. The finest dining.
So basically, yeah. So we had a lot to do. So we bonded, and it's just such a fun group of people. So we're, laughing our asses off half the time. And then, you know, running from killers and whatnot.
It's a pretty funny film, and it's got, you know, very strong tongue-in-cheek, sort of tongue-in-cheek Terminator, I guess, is how you might describe it. And I know you talked about the scene where Adam emerges, Dan, rather.
Yeah.
Adam. Let me show you how to do this, Dan. I'm going to take my shirt off. I'm going to go method directing. Dan came out of the shower with his top off, obviously, and it's hilariously funny, really, I guess. And I read that you said that you're to the end of the shoot because he was still working on his. Mm-hmm. So were there conversations with Adam going, Dan, how are you doing? He's got, I've got five abs.
Yeah, I've got
one
got
more and
one
then we're good.
One more up there and then it'll be even and it'll be good. Oh, yeah, he was working hard for that.
But there's some dispute over whether it was six abs or eight.
Eight.
It was eight.
No. It was
no.
Six.
Six. Okay.
Dan's probably saying eight, isn't he?
No, I think he's
the world's first ever nine pack.
Yeah, nine pack.
Nine
just
abs.
You can't see his face. It's just abs.
Just abs. That's all you're looking at, really. Yeah.
Both films have got great soundtracks.
Oh my God, I know.
Do you have them?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah.
And The Bling Ring as well. Is another one really good. Are you? Only two films with they're going to have
good music.
Yeah, send me
obviously.
Your music cues and I'll think about it.
Yeah, of course.
The Guest, though, we loved that soundtrack.
Amazing.
But I mean, these are things that obviously are added in post-production.
Well, actually, Adam had a playlist of music that he wanted to use that he sent to all of us. So we, not all the music exactly, but a lot of the artists and even the scene where I have my headphones on the bed, I was listening to the song that they ended up putting in the movie. So he knew a lot of, while we were filming the music, which was awesome to be able to kind of get the vibe of it, helped a lot. Yeah.
And what about on It Follows? How did...
I had no idea.
How did David know? But I mean, just the sound cue, the atmosphere and the air. Did you get a sense of that in filming, or did you sit down and watch it for the first time and think, that's the mood.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I knew what he was trying to create, but I had no... I mean, it brought a whole nother level, the music. I mean, just like how he explains it, there's really delicate kind of music and then this very harsh kind of loud, kind of painful sound. So it was a nice mix. I mean, it makes the movie for me. It kind of brings it all together.
We have to let you go and be pursued by other relentless journalists quite soon. But I wondered, you played a young Kate Winslet in Labor Day for Jason Reitman. Did she give you, because I guess when you reach her stage, you'd be chuffed to have a career like she's had.
Yeah.
Did she give you any... I'm sure she's not the sort of person who will come over and start foisting advice on you, but did you get the chance to talk to her about, you know, the choices and this, because you're bound to get more and more different sorts of scripts arriving. Did she give you any insight into how to, you know, you may not have a Titanic experience just yet, but did she give you any advice or guidance?
Yeah, I mean, it's what she said, and which I believe very strongly, is that, you know, you want to keep loving what you do. And so, you know, people might be telling you got to be doing this movie to get to here. And if you're not loving the characters in the script, then you're going to start probably hating your job. And you don't want that, because it's magical what we do. It's amazing. And you got to keep that alive, I guess.
Yeah. You could bond with her over swimming in pools.
Yeah. Definitely. Just
tanks. Just
tanks of, yeah.
Because I think she almost drowned. You didn't almost drown in It Follows.
No, I didn't, but I could have. Yeah. We could bond over easily. That. Yeah, easily.
If I just stop breathing and submerge myself for no reason.
and what's next for you? What's coming up?
Well, I just finished on the Fifth Wave, which is a young adult, really popular young adult novel. That's going to be kind of a trilogy thing, which I'm very excited about. I get to play this super kick-ass girl, Marksman's. And then when I get back from London, I start filming a movie called Tribes of Palos Verdes, which is kind of a darker drama, which I'm quite excited about.
We need to try and populate your IMDb trivia page
before
we let you go. Can you give us one random fact or passion? Or obviously, you're a keen kiteboarder and used to be a dancer.
Mm-hmm.
Give us something completely random.
Well, something that is kind of the most, I think, the most amazing thing I've ever experienced. I saw James Brown live when I was young. And that was I loved him as a kid, and I thought that's pretty cool that my age, not many people could say they've seen James Brown live. Yeah.
What was the standout song?
Oh, God. I mean, all of them. I mean, I remember he wore this mirrored outfit, you know, like suit all with mirrors on it. It was amazing.
That's going to be, you're going to be asked about that.
I know. Now that's
it's going to be the IMDb page. Saw James Brown when she was young. It's just going to be there on the IMDb.
that's all that matters.
Thank you so much for coming in, Micah Monroe.
Thank you very much. Thank you, guys.
At this point of recording, we haven't actually interviewed Micah Monroe, but she was nice. Let's just assume. I just assume she was lovely.
I think so.
In fact, I know she's lovely because I did a Q&A with her last night, and she's a very lovely person. Okay, time now for some movie news. Let's kick off. We mentioned this earlier on, that Neil Blomkamp, a couple of weeks ago, posted some concept art from an Alien movie that he'd been working on with Sigourney Weaver. I interviewed Sigourney Weaver back in September. I asked her what, you know, would she ever want to do a fifth Alien movie? And she said that she'd actually been having some conversations with some interesting young filmmakers about this, about, you know, finishing Ripley's story. Mm. Clearly, Neil Blomkamp, with whom she's worked on Chappie, which comes out on March 6th, was one of those directors. And last night, Fox gave the movie the green light. So what do we reckon?
This is, I think, pretty exciting. I mean, the concept art was dark and twisted and horrible, ugly way, you know, which is what we expect from the Alien movies. So it certainly caught the attention. You know, I think this, if we're going to go back to the Alien, you want to do something different. You want to go with somebody who has some kind of vision for it and some way to build on what we've seen already and extend it further. So it seems like this might not be a bad idea. I'm a little bit, not concerned, but bemused by the talk of Hicks being in this, though. That's a slightly weird scenario, given that he's, you know, pretty dead. And I know that death is no bar to appearing in an Alien movie. Mm-mm. But at the same time, I don't know. It just seems like that story is done with, and it's...
Yeah.
I loved him personally. I thought he gave one of the sexiest lines in movie history, but...
He was great.
Which one?
Nuke the site from orbit. It's the only way to be sure. But he says it after she says it in an acceptance of her authority on the matter. So it's just, it's wonderful.
Okay. Yeah, so the concept art, some of it's really interesting. Some of it shows Ripley sitting in the space jockey chair, which indicates that in this movie that they might go back again, I guess, to LV-426. Who knows? But also, there was some concept art of an old, scarred Hicks alongside Ripley, which indicates what, cloning? Or are they going to ignore Alien 3 and 4?
Yeah. Wouldn't be a worst idea, I suppose.
Yeah.
But I mean, he didn't seem, as much as I like him as a character and love that movie, he didn't seem integral to the Alien. I use the word mythos now, I think. I can't help it. But he didn't feel integral. He just, you know, he was just another character in that film and a good one.
I don't know.
So
about
I don't
know.
I don't feel like.
I don't know about that. I think there's. I think if James Dyer were here, who's a bigger fan of Aliens than I am, just saying something. I think there's a group of people who grew up loving Aliens and loving the end of Aliens. I think I've talked about my love for the end of Aliens in the past when they get away from the explosion at the very, very end and the rush of adrenaline you get, and then you put on Alien 3 and it all just turns to, you know, dust. And so, you know, it's been a group of people, and I think Blomkamp's probably the same age, probably right, you know, age group for that. He must have grown up loving that the end of that movie and loving Hicks and loving Newt and loving Bishop and wanted to see more of those characters instead of, you know, the ignominious burial at sea that they got.
There's something to be said for that, because the beginning of Alien 3 did feel like a real kick in the teeth in that sense.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's been a while now and, you know, let's move on, guys. It's good to have new characters sometimes and not just keep going back to the well, I think.
It's going to be a tricky one, isn't it? How do you introduce a character to a modern audience when the film that character last appeared in came out in 1986? That could be quite an interesting one. So here's Hicks, everybody. And then if you don't know who Hicks is, we recommend you rent Aliens. That could be interesting. Phil, we were talking about this in the office before we came over here, about the idea that if this does go ahead, this is a fifth Alien movie, but Fox are also still actively developing Prometheus 2.
Yeah.
So how's that going to work?
It's interesting. What they might try and do, I guess, is sort of tie them together a bit more, because you looked at that concept art. There are those shots of, you know, the sort of the space jockey, if you like, ship in what appears to be a huge kind of human hangar. So maybe there's an element of crossover here. I mean, they're obviously taking place in different time periods, so you can have them as different, you know, different stories, independent more or less of one another, until some giant Days of Future Past style crossover. But you could have them, you could develop the mythology in both, I guess, and just maybe make sure that they don't completely contradict each other.
Seems like a lot going on in the same universe, especially if you're talking about potentially retconning Aliens 3 and 4 as well, and trying to rebuild and trying to basically carry on from Aliens. Whilst they're trying to promote and market Prometheus. Mm-hmm. And you said Ridley Scott is obviously will be working with Neil Blomkamp on this, so there will be DNA.
Well, Ridley Scott has, you know, he's stated very clearly that he doesn't want to do the Alien again. He wants his Prometheus franchise to go in a very different direction and take that xenomorph in a very different direction, as we saw at the end of the film. So this is really interesting. It's not like X-Men. It's not like, you know, your typical, and this is obviously a new thing, but your typical shared universe. This is like a franchise stretching itself in two different directions. So you have one, Prometheus, which is going off into unexplored direction, and then Alien 5, which is delivering, you know, all the stuff that you really wanted Prometheus to give you, but it didn't quite give you? Well, this will give you all that stuff. That's my feeling.
Yeah, I think this could be great. And I don't think it's that complicated to get our heads around, because if we can understand Days of Future Past and Dawn of the Planet of the Apes and the Marvel universe, then we should be able to get our head around Prometheus and Alien, whatever the number this is. I'm excited. I'm interested to see where this goes.
Yeah. It's one of those ones where it's like a squaring of the circle, or it's come for Neil Blomkamp, but it's obviously weaned on this stuff, and his films are full of its influences, especially in their tech and weaponry, etc. To be doing this seems like a really logical thing, and is quite exciting. And I think he needs probably something like this to explore. He's obviously passionate about it. Hopefully he'll find daylight to do something of his own, and hopefully it will be, you know, an 18. I think that's going to be a big factor. I think it has to be balls out and scary and, you know, violent. Because I think, you know, you can't keep your powder dry, and that's going to be a discussion with the studio, I'd imagine, for him. Fingers crossed, though.
It is interesting, because the end of Alien Resurrection, it's so far in the future. So how does Hicks... Oh, wow. It's going to be fun finding out. Speaking of fifth installments, this week we had the official announcement that production is underway
of Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid. Sorry, Dead Men Don't Wear Tails. No, Dead Men Don't Declare Taxes. No, Dead Men do some, what they do? They don't. Dead Men Tell No Tales. That's what they do. That's what they do. Javier Bardem, Jeffrey Rush is back as Barbossa. Kevin R. McNally is back as the character he plays in that franchise. You've got other people as well.
Brenton Thwaites. The guy that really the whole franchise hangs off.
Brenton Thwaites.
Yes. Yes. Johnny Depp. Sorry.
Oh, Johnny Depp, yes. Yes, oh, back yes, as Captain Jack. And he's looking for the Trident of Poseidon.
I'm so excited about the Trident of Poseidon. I didn't think after the Fountain of Youth I could get any more excited about a movie MacGuffin. But the way they're heading relentlessly towards the Haddock of Eternal Life.
We've had the Loom of Fate. Why not?
The Whelk of Mystery in Pirate 7. This is the sort of shit that gets me out of bed in the morning. The Trident of Poseidon is a thing that they'll be trying to do something with. It'll be magical or not.
Yeah.
I'll tell you one thing for sure. It'll have three prongs.
It might not have three prongs.
Well, it's trident. It's in the name.
Ah, that's what it means.
We know it's a powerful artifact that bestows upon its possessor total control over the seas.
Told you.
Which kind of sounds like the one in the last couple of films, before the Fountain of Youth.
Yeah.
And we have ghost pirates, deadly ghost pirates, which kind of sounds like the ones we had in the first film.
Yeah.
It seems to me a little, and we have a member of the Cruise Bardem.
I'm not liking
family.
Your subtext here. I've got to be honest with you, Helen. But go on.
Well, it feels like maybe a little bit of a let's be charitable and call it a greatest hits.
But
now
if they get the Trident of Poseidon,
that's what I call Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah,
Volume 5.
Volume 5.
Genuinely, if they called it that, I would be there in a heartbeat. I will see it anyway. Obviously,
if they get this part, if they get the Trident of Poseidon, they could potentially get hold of a Horcrux.
They could. They could.
And then
it sounds like we're being somewhat dismissive of this movie, which is guaranteed to make $1 billion, obviously,
yes,
and been huge and stuff. And that's not dismissive. The first film, I think, is still great. The second film's got a lot of great things in it. The third film is definitely diminishing returns. Mm. Third film is not as good. The second film and the fourth film is directed by Rob Marshall, which tells you everything you need to know. And then we have the fifth film, which I hope. I mean, they're saying all the right things.
Maybe this will be the Fast Five of the franchise.
Maybe it will. That would be amazing.
I am back on board.
Maybe it will. If we can get Brick Tamlin in there, it'll be amazing. Imagine if he killed a guy with the Trident of Poseidon. That'd be amazing. Speaking of other films, other big franchise films and shared universes and all that jazz, the X-Men Cinematic Universe, as nobody's calling it at the moment, the XCU, is really getting underway. So this week we've had casting on X-Men Apocalypse.
Yeah.
We've had people complaining that Cody Smith-McPhee is too young to play Nightcrawler, which is just a ludicrous argument. Bamps and teleports around and has a German accent and is blue. Helen.
Yes.
Obviously, Nightcrawler we last saw in X-Men 2.
Yes.
It's a much older iteration of the character. What do you think of the casting of Cody Smith-McPhee as Nightcrawler?
I think I might actually be quite on board with it. If you think about it, this is set a good 25 years before X2. So it's somewhere in the 80s, right?
Yeah.
So he should be a younger character, even if we're assuming X-Men continuity makes any sense, which at this point is a huge assumption.
So if we're saying that X-Men 2 takes place in 2002...
Ish, yeah.
Ish.
It's meant to be near future.
So it's 19 years-ish. So this is 83.
Mm.
So, okay. Yeah, it makes sense. That makes sense.
Not too young, I don't think.
Yeah.
But he's got an interesting shape to his face, so that'll come through even when he's blue. So yeah, maybe we'll see him in his days with the Munich Circus. Very exciting. It does feel pretty crowded. So we've obviously got the core crew, McAvoy, Fassbender, Jennifer Lawrence, Nicholas Holt. You've got young versions of Storm, Cyclops and Jean Grey. You have Rose Byrne returning as Moira MacTaggert. You now have Cody Smith-McPhee. You have the Big Bad. You have, of course, Oscar Isaac, who we already discussed, who will be released from the front of Chris's car for the duration. It's a lot of people. I think what you need to do is do this sort of Quicksilver approach and just give everybody great moments. And if you do that, it doesn't feel quite so kind of crowded. I think if you're trying to just put everybody in the background of every scene, then it doesn't work. But hopefully if they can find good moments for everybody to have, then it could work brilliantly. I mean, even in X2, really, he has one great, great scene in that mm-hmm. opening and then a few nice little character beats. But he doesn't have a huge amount of screen time, really. So you could do quite a lot with Nightcrawler in quite a small space of time. I also think that this is another chance for them to produce Banff dolls, which I've always wanted since seeing them in the comics. So fingers crossed for that.
Interesting. One character we know who will no longer, or one actor rather, who will no longer be appearing in the XCU is Daniel Cudmore, who after 3 appearances as Colossus in X2, X-Men The Last Stand, and Days of Future Past, will not be returning for Deadpool, in which Colossus will appear.
I think that's kind of a shame. I always liked him as Colossus. Not that he had the most enormous role to fill.
Good finishing sentences of building there.
No, but I, you know, he looks the part. He had that sort of solidity about him for that character. So I will slightly miss him. But, you know, I do love Colossus as a character, though. So I'm if this is a sign that they're giving him more to do, then happy days, you know. That's got to be a good thing.
Yeah, it's a tough one, this, isn't it? Because it's probably fair to say he hasn't shown probably the full extent of acting ability in the 3 movies so far. He hasn't had a lot to do.
No, he hasn't.
And maybe Colossus has a much bigger part, so to speak, in this one. Event Horizon. And, so maybe they're looking for someone who's not just beefcake.
Yes.
But actually has some chops.
Pork chops?
Yeah. Some extra vegetables to go with the beef. Okay.
And then also in Deadpool, we heard that Gina Carano is going to be in it as Angel Dust, who's one of the Morlocks who live under the streets of New York, which is interesting casting for her. But apparently the bigger female role, which people thought she was taking, is actually going to Mirena Bakarin, of course, of Firefly fame. But we don't know exactly who she's playing, or at least I don't, unless somebody, you've heard something else, Chris?
No, I haven't heard anything yet.
So that'll be interesting. So some very kick-ass females there to be joining the Merc with the Mouth.
Absolutely. My fervent hope for Deadpool, apart from the fact that I just don't know if they go down the breaking the fourth wall route and he's very aware that it's in a movie and blah, 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 how that's going to fit into this wider XCU that they're establishing tonally and visually and all that. It's just, I hope they don't go down the route that kind of, for me, ruined the 2 Wolverine solo movies, which was they can't seem to resist the urge to just throw mutants at it. And the Wolverine was such a good, if he'd just been in Japan fighting people who weren't mutants, you have that awful last 20 minutes where it turns into a Bond film. It just, that's crazy to me. But if you keep it pared down and just have a fairly relatable low budget situation,
I think we're talking about a one in one out policy now, aren't we, on mutants and X-Men films?
Yeah,
the nightclub casting strategy, I call it.
Really?
Yeah. Casting notes like, no, sorry, mate.
So Daniel Cudmore's name's not down?
Currently not, no.
Oh, poor guy.
Yeah, interesting news on the Assassin's Creed, Ubisoft's beloved video game. I got told off for using the expression computer games. It makes me sound like an absolute idiot, apparently. Or a very clever person from 1987. Marion Cotillard's joined Michael Fassbender. I haven't played it. I'm very aware of it. I haven't played it, but I think I've watched my brother Nick play it. It looks like fun.
It's quite assassiny. There's a little bit of creediness going on. It's, you know.
Yeah, there's a creed. They have to sign up to the creed, unless it's the rock band Creed. I'm hazy on the details, but it's a great cast. I wouldn't imagine this will be quite, it won't have any kangaroos in buckets.
And this trio have recently teamed on Macbeth.
Macbeth, which, you know,
which promises to be the funniest adaptation of that.
That's going to be a laugh riot right there. Ali Plum of Empire Towers has coined the expression Macdeath for this one, which might hit the nail on the head. There's going to be some killing. I don't know what sort of... It's going to be a fun film, I think. It could, but could it be the best video game adaptation to date?
A high bar, isn't it?
Yeah.
I will say, what this story does tell me is that everybody had a good time making Macbeth.
Yes.
And don't hate each other, which would seem to be a good sign. That film, while slightly delayed, I think, from its originally planned release, is on track and all seems well.
Not necessarily a good thing, though, is that? As discussed previously.
You don't always want
cast to get on.
No, true, but at the same time, the fact that they are planning to work with each other again shows faith in each other's abilities, which might have been shaken if Macbeth is rubbish.
I would imagine Fassbender and Cotillard would be hard to persuade to join a video game adaptation, potentially.
Because they are
people that are very scrupulous about what sort of roles. That's impugning everyone else that's ever been in one. I shouldn't say that. But, you know, it's good. I think it's encouraging. They must have liked the script. obviously. And
assuming there is
really
one.
Really good actors.
This is good.
Assuming there is one, I don't know.
It would be a step up on most movies of the size that started probably without scripts. But anyway, my big question is, what's the catering going to be like? That's the big one.
That's the thing that everyone cares
medieval
about, Chris.
That's the question on everybody's lips. Right, that's news wrapped up in a nice little bow. Let's have a second guest on the show. He's a national treasure, a living legend, the Bill Nighyest man alive, with the exception of Phil the Semlian, of course. He's been bloody brilliant in a host of things, from Love Actually to Pride, and, yes, as my intro made clear, Shaun of the Dead. He is, of course, Bill Nighy. He crops up next week in the second best exotic Marigold Hotel, the sequel to... he came in recently to talk to Phil and Ali Plum about that movie and a whole heap more. Now, long-time listeners of the podcast will know that every now and again we have a sound snafu, and we had another one on this one. So I think this interview was actually recorded on someone's iPhone, as far as I can tell. So we do apologise for the sound quality, as in there may not be any, but do enjoy anyway.
Bill, I'm going to start with a slightly odd question, but I don't really mind asking odd questions, as you'll find out from the rest of this interview. But tell me the story of how you became the president of Crystal Palace's Women's Football Club.
Basically, I became the president of Crystal Palace Women's Football Team because I got in the wrong cab. And I got in a cab, and Charles, who turned out to be the cab driver, said, "Will you speak to my wife?" I said, which cab drivers and other people do occasionally ask me to do. They'll hand you the phone and they'll say, "Her name is Sandra." And you say, "Hey, Sandra, how are things with you?" And I said, "Yeah, okay." So I spoke to his wife. And he said, but prior to the phone call, he said, "Well, we've had a bit of a row and we haven't spoken for a while. And I wondered if you might have a word with her." I said, "Well, what am I going to be saying to your wife?" He said, "Well, just tell her that, you know, to come to her senses and let's discuss it." I said, "I don't think I'm going to be saying that to your wife." Anyway, I spoke to his wife. And afterwards he said, "You see, it's difficult because I'm a cab driver, therefore I'm out of the house a lot. But also, I am the manager of the Crystal Palace Women's Football Team." And I said, "Oh, right, well, I'm a Palace supporter." And he said, "Well, I know that." And then later he said, there was a silence, and then he said, "You wouldn't be our president, would you?" And it was, I don't know, and normally I would, you know, I do avoid being those, you know, taking any of those kind of positions. But I just thought, because it was the ladies' team, and I don't want to be celebrity fan or celebrity anything, frankly. But I did think, yeah, why not? It was quite, you know, and it was, you know, I'm creating the role, given that there's never been a president before. and it's turned out to be quite good fun. And we had a Q&A recently to raise money for the under 15s, I think, or something, to go to California for 10 days and play, you know, play all the schools over there. And that was hilarious. And we had a very good evening. And we raised some money. So, you know, I am proud and pleased to be... Charles calls me El Presidente.
Do you have a uniform? It sounds like you put...
Well, I'm pretty much wearing... I'm dressed as the president as we speak, which is pretty much what I wear.
Enjoying your epaulettes and your medals, Bill.
Yeah, well, I should have, shouldn't I?
How are they doing at the moment?
They're doing very well. They've got a very lively system. And, you know, they're in good shape.
Because you're a Croydon man. Were you a Crystal Palace fan sort of brought up?
My father came from Croydon, and my brother and my sister have lived in and around Croydon all their lives. And my grandfather, you know, my grandparents were in Croydon. But in fact, I grew up in Caterham, which is near Croydon. And everyone around there would be a Palace supporter because they're the nearest big club. So, and I also help out with a charity down there for disabled children. There's a box which the club pay half of per year, and we have to raise the other half, and the kids come down and they get in the box.
That's brilliant.
So it's a cool thing.
Here's to that. When we last spoke, you probably don't remember me speaking to you when we spoke last, but it was for About Time. I spoke to you about how people approach you in the street and what they talk to you about, and you told me that you can tell pretty much from their age.
Oh, yes.
25 to 35, Shaun of the Dead, 35 plus, Love Actually.
Yeah.
With the success of the best exotic Marigold Hotel, and I am no way in any doubt that this one's going to be success now. Do you have 65-year-olds or 60-year-olds coming
up? I am now poster boy for OAPs. Mm. I made the cover of Saga magazine.
That's privilege.
You know, you see what I'm saying? I am very big in that particular demographic now. No, yeah, of course, obviously you do. But this film seems to have spread around a little bit, and you get some quite surprisingly young people coming up.
Is that true?
We enjoyed that, yeah. I don't think it could have done the business it did if it had relied entirely on the over 60s. I don't think there's that many around. But, to take whatever it took, all these millions of dollars. So, I am now, I've got it covered. What with Pirates of the Caribbean for the under nines.
Yep.
And indeed from 9 to 90, I've got it pretty much covered.
I was going to ask, I read that it was not a close run thing, but there was a chance that it could have been a Dutch Davy Jones. Was there ever really much chance that you'd be doing a Dutch accent for that?
Yeah, no, I remember taking a call in the back of a car on the way home from work, and Gore Verbinski, the director, I wasn't entirely sure that I should be in the film, and he was saying, come on, it's a pirate movie, how many times do you get to be in a pirate movie? I said, well, yeah, and then the reason I was reluctant was because I didn't know how to play it. It wasn't because of any disrespect to the film. I just thought, I don't know what to do. I said, well, how would he speak? How would he sound? He said, wet. I said, okay, that's good, that's fine. I said, but I get it. But where would he come from? He said, well, he could be Dutch. I said, Dutch? Why Dutch? He said, well, because the ship is called the Flying Dutchman. I thought, oh, yeah, right. And I was thinking, nobody knows how to do Dutch. Because, Dutch is like, I'm quite good at accents, but Dutch is, it would take 6 months if you could indeed pull it off. And then I quickly said, what about Scots? And he said, well, how does that sound? So I ended up in the back of this car doing a Scottish accent, trying to do a wet Scottish accent in the back of a car. And he went, yeah, that sounds great. Anyway, and I ended up as a sort of Scotsman.
That's how you get gigs, in the back of a taxi.
That didn't translate into his on-set direction, though. It wasn't like, Bill, give me more wetness in this next take.
No, we never used the word wet again.
Just a bit damper, just 12%.
Yeah, that would have been good. That I understand.
I also hear that Stephen Polyakov once said, don't wiggle your eyes so much.
Yeah, it was the very first note that Stephen Polyakov ever gave me, and it was I heaved a sigh of relief when he said it to me, because that I can do. I know how to stop winging my eyes about. If they come up and they hand you some psychiatry, you know what I mean? Well, they talk about secondary energy and primary energy. Well, then I just, forget about it. Because I don't know what you mean. Because acting couldn't be more of a practical activity. It's like you need practical help. It's no good, psychology up to a point, but not really. In the end, don't wiggle your eyes about is my kind of director. I was trying to tell George V that the Russian arm of his family had been slaughtered in a basement. And it was obviously a very moving, moment. And I thought what might help, obviously subconsciously, I thought if it might help if I wiggle my eyes about.
You could have made him wet.
I could have made
that's,
him. Yes,
that's from The Lost Prince, isn't it? The Polyakov TV, which was beautiful. I absolutely adore. The second best exotic Marigold Hotel, you were obviously the Don from the first film, on the cover of Saga magazine, new demographics, the big man, Richard Gere, this guy. He's done a few things previously, but he's not probably that well known in these circles. Turns up on set. Do you embrace him first day? Because he doesn't really know. You guys have all worked together. You've bonded. You've had a lot of fun together on the film. It looks like it was a lot of fun to film. Yeah. Is there a little bit of frostiness to start with, or do you just embrace him into the...
No, he was immediately embraced. I had actually worked with him once before when I was very young, when I was 20-something, and he was 20-something, obviously. No, he entered the language very simply. You do become invisible, I observed, when you stand next to Richard Gere, which is quite handy. If you want to take a break from being visible, just go and stand somewhere near Richard, particularly with the female... population of the world, which is something that I'm accustomed to. It's not.
Has he been on the cover of Saga magazine?
I don't think so. Eat that.
The second question is: he El Presidente?
No. Is he? Has he got any connection or any influence over the Crystal Palace ladies' football team? I don't think so.
You presumably he would have mentioned it.
He would have. They would have told me. In fact, he'd be president. Come on, let's face it. If he called up now and said, "Do you know what? I'd like to be president," if they, I would no longer be president.
Let me say this to you, though, Bill. If you were standing next to Richard Gere in front of the Crystal Palace ladies football team, you would not be invisible. They would be looking at you.
Well, it's probably the only situation in which I would remain visible, because I am El Presidente.
Quite so.
I wondered if there's any analogy with your experiences on Harry Potter, because you came to the franchise quite late, I suppose, in the day, and everybody had been working for a long time, and this world had been established, and you'd had directors repeating films, and you came on a little late in the day. Even as an experienced actor, is there just a tiny sense of first day of school when you turn up on set?
Oh, yeah, but then that's the same with every single job. I hate starting jobs, and any actor will tell you, and it doesn't matter how long you've been doing it. I am not sustained by precedent. I'm not reassured by, anything that's gone before. And the first day on Harry Potter was the same as any other day. You don't sleep. You arrange to be as exhausted as you possibly can before you walk on the set. You're paranoid, insecure, and unsure. That's standard. That's an actor's life. Mm. Unless you're mad, there's no way around it, or on drugs. And even then you fuck up. So it's not, but the only thing that I did have going for me was that I'd worked with David Yates 3 times before on 3 very different kinds of things, and he's one of the great directors, and I like him enormously. So, I had him on my team kind of thing. So that helped a bit.
Going back to getting kind of noticed, I was wondering, after The World's End came out, one of the things that I wanted to talk about as soon as I finished watching the film was, that's Bill Nye. He's doing The Network. He is The Network. Do people ever talk to you about that? And following on from that, how did it feel to set up one of the best jokes in the film with just what is it that you want to do?
Oh, yes. Yeah, it felt very, very good. I was very flattered that I was very pleased that those actors should speak with my voice. The fact that Martin Freeman at one point spoke with my voice was very, very satisfying. I'm a very big fan of Martin's and a friend of Martin's, and that amused me a lot. People do ask me about it. Yeah, as again, the 25 to 29 or whatever they are, usually male, not always. But
the name of your memoir, right there.
Yes, quite. The Edgar Rice, Simon Pegg, Nick Frost Brigade. Mm. They are, they are very well disposed towards me. As the older member of the franchise, I am one of the only, I think, 4 other actors who have been in all of the Cornetto trilogy, which is some distinction. And people often ask about The World's End and about, Shaun of the Dead and about Hot Fuzz.
Does anybody ever say to you, "Oh, fuck off, you big lamp"?
Not yet, but it's a great line.
It's a great line.
It's a fantastic line.
It's a privilege to be given that, to be receive that insult.
I know.
And when was the last time someone whispered in your ear, "Oh, fuck, wank, bugger, shitting, arse, cunt, hole"? Because you told me before that people do genuinely, they see you on the street and then they come up to you in your ear and go,
"Yeah,
shit, fuck, bugger."
Yeah, no, that's true. That happens on a regular basis. They also say, "Hey, kids, don't buy drugs. Become a rock star. People give you." That's another big one. Or "Antor Deck." That's another one.
This is a great line.
Just shouting "Antor Deck" at you.
The finest moments in Love, actually, I think everybody would agree. But that's obviously a Christmas staple, but it's not your only Christmassy film. This is a very tenuous segue into probably one of the lesser explored corners of your illustrious CV, which is the Bergerac Christmas special from 1991.
Jesus.
I don't know if you've been asked about that today. I would imagine probably not. But I don't even
know. Was it a Christmas special?
You were. Yeah, I had a look.
You played Santa,
yeah, Christmas
Bill.
Special.
Did I?
No.
I wasn't Santa, no. No, I had a look on YouTube.
You could tell me I did and I'd believe you.
Oh, no,
so
really?
So long ago.
It was a while ago. Did you were, I think you were scheming against John Nettle's character.
I was a bad guy, I remember that, and I know, I remember doing the job, but I can't remember anything about the story or anything like that.
Was it fun?
Was it Christmas?
It was a Christmas special.
Blimey, that's quite posh. I'm going to have that added to... Did it say Christmas special on my CV? Oh,
yeah,
good.
Yeah, yeah. You need to get home and type it up.
We want that on there.
You're also in Minder, I believe.
I was in Minder. I was also in the very first Wycliffe.
Really?
And I was also in the very first Peak Practice.
No.
Yeah, baby. I was a pioneer in terms of both those series. I was in Ep 1.
Wow. You like the Christopher Columbus of the Peak District.
Exactly. I'm the guest red herring, of the number one episode. Yeah. So I've been around.
I get around. Don't worry about it.
You make things happen.
Yeah, exactly.
Were you in any way part of the driving force that made Dad's army a going concern?
Original... Oh, you mean...
Not the original one, no. Not Ep 1.
Oh, right. No, I actually watched Ep 1 the other day. Ep 1 of Dad's Army, if you buy the box set, which is in black and white, as were the first, I don't know, three series in the 60s, is actually absolutely bloody marvellous.
Yeah.
It's really, really good. It's before they get into uniform. It's when they get the letter saying you must form the Home Guard. Oh. They're all in black suits in the bank.
Yes.
And they have to audition possible army members. It's very, 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 very...
It's the origin story. Yeah. Did you see the film? The film that they did?
No.
They spun, obviously, out of the series.
No,
they shot it in just outside London in, like, Chalfont St Peter. But you guys obviously went up and shot in Yorkshire, in Scarborough, didn't you?
Yeah, we were based in Scarborough. We shot largely in Bridlington, Beverley, and places like that.
I was lucky enough to go on set, I guess the end of last year. And you weren't there that day, but Toby Jones and all of the, many of the rest of the squad were in action. And I have such a good feeling about this film. It was just hilarious to be there and witness it. I understand you and Catherine Zeta-Jones was there and you were all staying in Scarborough, bringing a bit of Hollywood magic to Scarborough. I guess, did you have a good time bonding with the guys?
One of the reasons that the job was attractive to me was that I knew that I'd be sitting somewhere near Michael Gambon for 7 weeks in Bridlington, and I thought, you know, you can't really miss an opportunity like that, because Michael Gambon would make me laugh every day for 7 weeks, which is exactly what happened, because he makes everybody laugh.
Yes.
He makes me laugh to the point where you think you'll never take another breath.
Yes, that happened on set that day.
Really?
Yes.
He is absolutely, endlessly hilarious. And he's also kind of my role model, which means I'm in real trouble. But no, he is actually, I admire him as much as I admire any actor in the world ever. And he is, as the cliche has it, you know, he's touched by genius. And I've seen him be, I'll never see anyone act better than Michael Gambon. And he is a kind of hero. But he also makes me laugh. So, and it was very, very funny. And Toby, as you saw, Toby Jones is brilliant as Captain Mannering. Danny Mays is brilliant as Walker. You know, Sir Tom and Sir Michael. And they're all, you know, perfectly cast. And so who knows? You know, I did resist it at first, because, you know, you think, come on, it's Dad's Army, leave it alone, you know. But the script was very, very good, and everyone involved, then it suddenly the cast started to mount up, and you thought, well, maybe the whole thing might work.
There's enough comic timing in that lineup to sort of power Greenwich Mean Time, I'd say. And for a lot of people, it was like, really, they're doing this? And then you saw the first picture of the cast together, and you're like, okay, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Are there any lines that you think people are going to quote at you in years to come that spring to mind? Anything you can share with us? Or any of the classic quotes?
Do be quiet, Frank. That's the one I remember. You know, don't be stupid, Frank. But there are lots. All the catchphrases that they're kind of snuck in late, just when you think you're not going to get. They don't like it up them. You know, they sneak it in, they're all your favourite stupid things from the show are in there. You know, the Hamish McCall, who wrote the script, has done he's watched every single. You know, the box set is about that wide. You know, it's like 10, 12, I don't know, whatever it was, 12 years of Dad's Army. So, and he's distilled it pretty marvellously.
I cannot wait for people to whisper in your ear as you walk down the street, they don't like it up them.
No.
That's going to be...
They don't like it up them.
I think one final question, if I may.
Yeah.
It's now a franchise, isn't it, really? But the Exotic Marigold Hotel franchise is going great guns. Are you contracted for a third film? Would you do a third film? And what would you call it?
I am not contracted for a third film. I would be there probably like a shot. When the second one was suggested, Judy Dench said, well, they better hurry up. So with the third one, they better get their skates on.
My suggestion to call it was the second best Exotic Marigold Hotel 2.
That's very funny. That's very good. Yeah.
All right, I'll go and tell them. We'll make that happen.
That's very good.
Anyway, thanks again. Absolute pleasure, sir.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Hot Bill Nighy fact. I once saw him crossing the street in Camden. He crossed it in a very classy way. Hotter Bill Nighy fact. I almost always type his name as Bill Nighy.
Me too.
Mm.
which is quite sexy, really.
Yeah, that's the live Schreiber.
Spellcheck Nemesis. Some lovely reviews now coming your way. A lot of films out this week that deserve your attention. We'll really can only talk about three. We don't have a lot of time because Micah Monroe is about to bang on the door. Let's start with the big film about the world, the kinky world of BDSM. Yes, of course, it's Peter Strickland's The Duke of Burgundy. Philcat.
Yes.
You're a man who looks like he knows the kinky world of BDSM inside out. It's just the way you have that shirt just chutting ever so tastefully.
Just
over your
on
jumper.
The floor. Yeah. Yeah. I should have put trousers on for this. But there you go. Peter Strickland, I think, I would mention him in the same breath as a sort of Ben Wheatley, as somebody that's just really could go on to do really, truly great things. He's very, very talented and he's not afraid to tackle unusual material. As his first film, Catalin Varga, was shot entirely in, I believe, Hungarian. So a brave filmmaker, and this is unlike any film you'll see this year. It's beautifully shot, it's beautifully composed, it's a film about, it's a weird kind of, it would make a weird double bill with 50 Shades of Grey. It's like a really, really classy version of 50 Shades of Grey, and it's a film about a dominant and a submissive relationship, two women living in a kind of undefined society, only women in this film. It feels like sort of 70s Italy in a forest. It's that kind of thing. It's like it's just out of place and dislocated, but the focus is on this couple. They have obviously had the glory days of their relationship, and they're at the point now where things are starting to get a bit done and boring. And there are things in this film that are sort of specialist interest, should we say, in terms of their sort of sexual proclivities, but it's really a film about their relationship and about relationships in general, and it's very emotional throughout this. And there's some astonishing things. It breaks the third wall and the fourth wall. It's got a beautiful soundtrack by Cat's Eyes, which is fantastic, and I would recommend the heck out of it. We've given it 5 stars. Mm-hmm. It's so distinct and hard to describe, but it's a kind of a moody, strange, romantic, out there movie. And I would really recommend going to see if you can.
Great performances.
The performances are fantastic from both of the women, Chiara De Anna and Sidsi Babat Knudsen. Again, I always get the hardest names to pronounce. The two of them as the two women, one slightly younger than the other, convey all these kind of insecurities, and they have these strange rituals. It kind of twists itself around. The dynamic that you're introduced to when the film starts, one of them is basically kind of the cleaner and the servant. Mm-hmm. And she comes and she does all of these things and she gets brutally punished and for doing anything wrong. It's just like one of our issue meetings, really. It's a lot of kinky nonsense. But then you realise that actually that's not what's happening at all, and it twists itself around on its head, and the whole dynamic of the relationship shifts, and then it shifts again, and it keeps shifting in really interesting and actually really quite funny ways. It's a funny film. I haven't seen 50 Shades of Grey yet, but I understand that it's not perhaps mocking itself in that way, and this is a film that kind of does. There's a scene where a woman turns up to make a bed for them. They want a bed where one of them can sleep in a cupboard underneath the other one, and they have a very po-faced deadpan conversation about how quickly they can have this bed made for them, and it's kind of hilarious, but at the same time it's in earnest, and that's Peter Strickland can kind of do that. If you've seen Barbarian Sound Studio, you realise he can do the absurdity and the horror. And in this film, he does the absurdity and the romance and the sex, and it all kind of gels into this wonderful sort of portrait of a relationship.
Fantastic. 5 stars then for The Duke of Burgundy, which seems perhaps in stark contrast to 50 Shades of Grey, which we didn't talk about last week, Helen, because
they wouldn't show it to us, no.
To critics. Obviously, it made I believe the technical phrase is a shit ton of cash around the world, over 200 million around the world last weekend, with the people flocking to see Mr. Grey. I can tell from your face already what you're going to say, but I saw someone yesterday. I popped into cinema very, very brief yesterday to pick up some pick and mix with Nick. and we overheard a lady who was on her own who popped in and asked for 5 tickets to 50 Shades of Grey, 5 tickets for like a 3 o'clock screening. I just kind of think, okay, so are you friends
joining you later. I mean, you know, but that for me, that kind of sums up the phenomenon that is 50 Shades of Grey. But
yeah.
What do we think of the film itself?
Well, listen, the film is a pretty good attempt at adapting a novel that should never have been attempted. It's not a very good...
A novel that should never... The adaptation should never have been attempted?
Or
you
novel.
Said E.L. James should
Everything
never have...
Everything about it. Yeah. There was a great line in Anthony Lane's review in The New Yorker where he says that you can't believe that this was written in the author's first language or even her fourth, which is a little mean, but not entirely wrong. But this is actually a pretty good adaptation. I would say that Dakota Johnson is really genuinely good at making a character who is nothing on the page, literally nothing, and turning her into someone that you could actually not just see as an actual human being, but also someone that you might actually like, which is very, very impressive indeed, given what she has to work with. So I think she did well there. I think that Sam Taylor-Johnson did well, generally speaking, with the adaptation. There are some wildly obvious moments, like she meets Christian Grey for the first time, played by Jeremy Dornan, and she comes outside and it starts raining. It's like, oh, for God's sake. But generally speaking, I think Sam Taylor-Johnson does a good job. But as you've all heard, you know, the story here is the problem. The story is Anastasia Steele, played by Dakota, meets Christian Grey, played by Jamie Dornan, who is a billionaire, which is ridiculous at the age of apparently 28.
It happens.
It doesn't happen
on Two and
like
a Half
this.
Men. Ashton Kutcher's character is pretty young and he was a billionaire.
Okay, it happens in this and in Two and a Half Men.
I think Mark Zuckerberg might have been...
Yeah, but he isn't hot and can't fly a helicopter.
He's hot to me.
Probably.
He's a billionaire.
Well, yeah. Okay, gold digger. Anyway, the point being, she falls crazy. She feels crazy about him. He's actually the same way and slightly stalkerish, but also wants her to be his submissive to his dominant and wants her to sign a contract agreeing what she will and will not do for him. Now, there are great scenes here. Like when they actually negotiate the contract, it's genuinely funny. It's clever. It's a little bit sexy. Most of the time, this isn't sexy. Most of the time, especially when they have their clothes off, it isn't sexy. And that's a bit of a problem.
Isn't that a singular failure of a film that is built around the sex? I mean, everyone kind of is building up to it, so to speak, going, what's the sex like?
Yeah, but I think people are being snide about this in a way that they wouldn't about things aimed at men. I think there's a tendency to be further down on this than we would be about equivalent things. And so I'm kind of a little bit, you know, when people in some reviews are reviewing the audience, well, that doesn't have anything to do with anything.
I've seen that a lot.
People are, you know, the sex scenes are working for a lot of that audience, I think. They didn't particularly work for me. And I do think that they're crippled by the fact that if you show him really getting into the sort of the Sado side of BDSM, then it makes it very, very difficult for a cinema audience to in any way feel for him or root for him.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they've dialed back on that to the extent where it becomes, well, what's the big deal about all of this? I don't see what all the fuss is about. The scenes where they're just having, you know, vanilla sex are probably a lot, you know, closer to sexy. So there are moments here that are really good and show something really special. I think Sam Taylor-Johnson should come out of this with her head held pretty high. And she will, obviously, because it's made huge amounts of money all around the world and avoided the worst of the backlash that she could have expected. I think Dakota Johnson will emerge from this unscathed, so far at least. We'll have to see how the next two films that she signed up for go. And Jamie Dornan isn't terrible. He's just saddled with the worst bits. The worst bits and the worst role. So it's about as good as we could have hoped, but still, the two-star review that Ian gave it seems fair enough to me.
Two stars then for 50 Shades of Grey, which I imagine most of you have already seen.
Or never will.
Or will never admit to seeing, same way that you did with the book. Oh, I've never read that book, what? okay, we're huge fans of Michael Mann here at Empire, so the fact we've gone 6 years without a new film for the master of the modern thriller has left us feeling... a little blue, because he likes blue. But he's back this week with Black Hat, a prescient thriller in which Chris Hemsworth plays a hacker plunged into a world of international but damned good-looking intrigue. Mostly he'll try and find out why the hell I just pronounced prescient. Prescient! But there you go. Hell's Bells, I'm going to come to you once again on this one.
Yeah. So this one starts off with a cyber attack basically devastating a Chinese nuclear plant. which is obviously a big problem. And the Chinese team up with the Americans to try and figure out what went wrong, because of course both countries understand this is a big problem, a big concern. And soon enough, there's also an attack on the US stock market. So it seems like they're right to get together. Now, one of the Chinese sort of experts here used to go to college in the US, to MIT, in fact, where he was roommates with a hacker called Hathaway, played by Chris Hemsworth. He's now in prison, but they get him out to help with this hack, which uses parts of a code that that pair made years before. That's where they kind of come in. And they basically go globetrotting to try and figure out what happened, what went wrong, and who did it, essentially. So it's quite compelling for stretches of this. I will say that they avoid a lot of the major hacker, you know, problems. They don't have people working on Macs, which very few hackers do, for example. They don't have, you know, all of those, you know, loading screens, kind of bars going across as everybody just stares at this green bar failing to progress. But they still do a little bit of the sort of hackers-esque, you know, shooting through the computer's architecture, like it's wires, and you're a bit like, dude.
But Michael Mann's a man for whom, you know, verisimilitude is king. So, you know, he sent, for example, Colin Farrell on dummy smuggling runs for Miami Vice. And so I imagine that this is fairly true to actual hacking without wanting to strand an audience in a sea of jargon.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. I think the problems with it a little bit are, without wanting to get too into any spoilers, it feels like despite having quite a lengthy running time, the characters are a little bit underdeveloped. Despite, again, a great cast. You've got people like Viola Davis in there. You've got big, big Chinese stars like Tang Wei and Wong Li-hom and then, you know, more American and international stars like Jordan Ortiz. It's a really, really good cast, but they aren't really given very much to work with. Which is a little bit of a problem. And even, you know, even Hemsworth's hacker, I wanted him to have a philosophy. I wanted him to have an outlook on life. And he really doesn't. And he's meant to be this super genius guy. So surely he should have something in his life beyond being incredibly violent and incredibly intelligent. And those are the only two things we're really given about him. He's a nice guy, but he has a horrendous temper and sometimes snaps. That's it. And that's a bit weird. And again, I don't want to get into spoilers, but when you find out what's actually going on, it's a massive, massive letdown for me, a huge one. And after that, I thought that the adversarial relationship that you need in a film like this wasn't there. And the big sort of final confrontation, I find completely bafflingly staged. So it kind of lost me there at the end. But some really, really good things there along the way.
Okay, so it feels like three stars then for Black Hat. That's what we gave it. And okay, we don't have a lot of time left, sadly, so we're going to race through the also-outs. Also out this week is Cake, in which Jennifer Aniston is surprisingly excellent, although she didn't get Oscar nominated, which I believe was the goal. We gave that three stars. It's a harrowing drama and not your usual knockabout Jennifer Aniston comedy. Also, there's a noodle-begging Ethan Hawke time travel thriller from the Spielberg brothers, Predestination, which we gave four stars, and that's out this week. There's also another less good time travel thriller project, Almanac. So it's a good week for time travel movies. And that's it for this week's Empire Podcast. Join us next week for more formulated fun, when we'll be joined by the wonderful Margot Robbie.
Event Horizon, Chris.
Event Horizon. Until then, it's goodbye from Helen.
Goodbye.
It's goodbye from Phil.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to clean off the bugs on Oscar Isaac's face. Not a sex thing, because he's on my car. Event Horizon. See you next week.